Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Princeton University Press Ideas Podcast, a joint production of Princeton University Press and the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, and today I'm speaking with Renee Berglund, author of the book Natural Magic, Emily Dickinson, Charles Darwin, and the Dawn of Modern Science. Renee, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, so I think the best way to introduce myself is to say that I teach literature and writing at Simmons University in Boston, and that I love the outdoors and I love old books.
Well, I can't argue those loves. I happen to share them myself. So what led you to write a book, which I thought it was such a fascinating blend of subjects? There are books about Emily Dickinson. There are books about the emergence of science. Books about Charles Darwin. What led you to write a book that really blended all these together in the way that that you do?
Well, I have been trying to write a book about Emily Dickinson for a long, long time, and the problem that I kept encountering as I would try to write a book about Emily Dickinson was that I'd get fascinated by one small thing and it would lead me toward a whole other book project. So, for example, I think I started out, I wanted to write about Dickinson and astronomy, and I was trying to understand what astronomy meant to Dickinson. And as I studied early 19th century astronomy, I discovered Maria Mitchell, and I got totally off track and wrote a whole book about the great 19th century astronomer, Maria Mitchell. So then when that was finished, I turned back towards Dickinson, and I was still trying to tackle what, I know she was a scientific poet and I know she was fascinated by science, but what did that mean to her? And then I started to explore the Darwinian aspects of her poetry and resisted as hard as I could just writing another book about Darwin, and decided instead to try to make this book a story of both Dickinson and Darwin, and how science changed during the 19th century, and how science for Dickinson came through Darwinian perspectives. It does make for kind of a hopscotchy story where I go back and forth from Amherst, Massachusetts to Kent in England, and from Dickinson to Darwin. But I feel like by putting the two of them together, I was able to capture something about the big changes that happened in the sciences in the middle of the 19th century.
One of the things I enjoy about books like yours is the fact that you could take these two people who don't have necessarily a direct connection, that they don't necessarily meet or their lives don't exactly intersect, but at the same time you can find within it so many connections. And I thought your approach was really fascinating, especially when you use it to talk about this transition that is taking place in Western thinking during this period about concepts of science and magic. As you point out at the beginning, Darwin, didn't call himself a scientist. That was a word that wasn't even invented till, he was already, on the Beagle and everything. And how, he thought of himself as a naturalist. You get this really interesting conversation about natural science and natural magic. I was wondering if you could start us off by explaining perhaps the distinction, like what, is natural science, what is natural magic, and maybe a bit about this decoupling that you described that is taking place during this period of their lives.
Okay, so my book is called Natural Magic. And the reason I chose that title was because I was really interested by the fact that there's a book about what today we would call science, about empirical investigations of the physical natural world, that was published in the 17th century that was called Natural Magic when it was translated into English. So natural magic meant in the 17th century, it meant empirical investigations of the material world. And then there's a book in 1832 called Natural Magic, which means where natural magic means almost exactly the opposite, where David Brewster is saying natural magic is a dark conspiracy. And it's when people who know about the natural world use their knowledge to manipulate people. And so he was, Brewster in the 1830s and the 19th century was terribly against natural magic because he thought it was about secrecy and manipulation. And I understand what he meant about how you could, for example, and a story that's been in the news a lot lately is that Christopher Columbus used his knowledge of an eclipse to intimidate Jamaican islanders. So he knew they didn't, and he used his knowledge, his secret knowledge, for his own political motivations. But that's not what it originally meant. It originally meant that it was trying to find the wisdom about the secret, mysterious things that happen in the natural world, like electricity, birth, death, gravity, all these things that we can't really see and don't necessarily understand, but that we can investigate empirically. So what I was interested in is what got lost when you took magic out of the equation and stopped talking about the mystery that's at the heart of so many of those questions about natural science and the material world. And I think that the figures that I look at, Charles Darwin and Emily Dickinson, both saw it as a great loss when the idea of natural magic disappeared, because what it meant was that empirical science no longer really made room for the emotions of wonder and marvel, and also for really didn't grapple as it once had with these unsolvable mysteries at the heart of everything. So Charles Darwin, for example, at the beginning of On the Origin of Species, he calls The Origin of Species the mystery of mysteries. And that's a very magical way to approach it. When you de-emphasize the mystery, the natural world begins to seem more mechanical and dry. And people start to think that maybe it's not appropriate to respond to the world around us with emotion, but only with reason. And that's what I wanted to explore, is in order to really, really come to grips with the natural world, do we have to just get rid of mystery and get rid of emotion and only focus on reason? Or can we recover some of that early 19th century sense of relating to the natural world in every dimension? That's kind of what I'm hoping for. And that's what I argue for in the book, is that let's not give up reason. Let's not give up empiricism at all. That's definitely not. But let's also make space for the magic that is also all around us.
Your association of it with Emily Dickinson, you know, superficially seems perfectly natural, in the sense of that she was coming at it with a poetical mindset, that she was you know, seen as an artist. But with Darwin, it might seem more surprising at first to think of him as a person who we nowadays, you know, venerate as one of the greatest scientists, being someone who, you know, in effect is lamenting the fact that the magic has gone out of science. Which, but as you explain, you know, the two have a lot more in common and have, you know, a convergence of thought that we don't often respect. As you've already alluded to, you know, Emily Dickinson was, you know, had a very interesting engagement with science, one that I must confess was really fascinating to read about, because I was so unfamiliar with it. And of course, Darwin himself is not a, you know, a desk-bound scientist who's just, you know, looking at samples. He's a person who has a literary past in his family, one that he isn't rejecting, but is in fact embracing.
Yeah, that's true. I think you know, it's easier to write a book if you really, really like the people you're writing about. And I just adore Charles Darwin. He's such a wonderful, wonderful person. It was really fun to sort of follow along with his story. I think it was Adam Gopnik wrote a book about Darwin and Lincoln, actually, another pair who didn't meet, but they were born at the same time. And for Gopnik, he talks about Darwin as one of the inventors of modern prose style, that he's one of the great writers in the English language. And I think Gopnik is right about that. He's a very, very beautiful writer and a careful writer and extremely prolific. He published a dozen books at least. It's actually hard to count them because there's so many translations and editions and small books and large books, but many, many books, all of them just remarkably beautiful in their writing. It's also, if you think about your understanding, you know, just our basic understanding of the way Darwin explains natural selection, some of the things that are important about it are kind of surprising. For one thing, death is really important. So death and extinction and these really big, heavy, tragic concepts are important in shaping how species develop and change. And for another, beauty is remarkably important in sexual selection, right? It's an aesthetic process, as he describes it. So you have these huge aesthetic and mysterious ways of thinking that are remarkably important to Darwin. And then he writes about them very, very beautifully. He's a great literary figure as well as a great scientist. But you're right. I think most people don't necessarily expect that. They don't expect to imagine Darwin as a writer who's fascinated by mystery and fascinated by the unknown. I'm not the first person to think about it. I'd say there are literary scholars, Gillian Beer and Robert Richards, who've written about Darwin's interest in literature and his influence on literature. And then also there's George Levine, who describes Darwin as a secular enchanter. And that idea, as I was starting out, was really, really important to me. Like, what does that look like? A secular enchanter who's like interested in enchantment, but not necessarily interested in religion. And that was something that I think Darwin and Dickinson have in common and that I really wanted to explore and try to understand.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a little bit further in terms of those comparisons, because we've already discussed two of them. And I think that they're ones that, you know, that explain how these seemingly disparate figures were a lot more alike. What other ways, as you were exploring, as you unpack their lives in your book, do we see other intersections and commonalities in terms of their views, their perspectives, and their upbringing?
Well, one of my favorite things in the book is just putting their childhood portraits side by side. They look almost exactly alike, which is really surprising. It's like, wow, these two children look alike, and they both grew up in the kinds of families where their parents hired people to make formal portraits of them. They were also, although Darwin grew up in England, and Dickinson grew up in the United States. They were both children of the professional classes. Dickinson's father was a lawyer, and Darwin's father was a physician. And those classes, those emerging professions in the early 19th century were very similar, whether you were in the U.S. Or in Britain. So they had very similar social milieus. They both had families that were incredibly concerned with education. Their families had really different attitudes towards science. And this might surprise listeners. Darwin's family was not interested in Darwin having a scientific education at all. That was not really an option for him when he was going to school. And instead he first tried his hand at medical school and then ended up going to Cambridge University and training to be a clergyman, thinking that he'd be a sort of a parson naturalist. For Dickinson, she was about 20 years younger than Darwin, and so the educational landscape had changed. But also, Amherst College, which was right across the street from her house, had a new approach to education that was really different from Cambridge University, where you didn't have to do science as a hobby, but people could actually study science at the university level. That was available to Dickinson, but it wasn't available to Darwin. And so that was, it's kind of a commonality, but it's also kind of a difference. When Darwin was studying science, he was not doing his homework. He was refusing to study, like to conjugate Latin verbs as his teachers wanted him to. And he was just instead doing experiments in the backyard. When Dickinson was studying science, she was doing exactly what her teachers, first at Amherst Academy and then at Mount Holyoke, wanted her to do. They wanted her to study botany, chemistry, astronomy. So she was being not at all a rebel by doing that, but she was being a very obedient student. It's surprising, I think, to lots of people that in this respect, Dickinson is not rebellious at all. She just goes right along. And it's Darwin who's rebelling by insisting that it's important to him to study geology and beetles and seaweed, all of which his teachers were keeping out of the curriculum in one way or another. So one of their connections is these families that value education. And then as time goes on, they have some pretty close connections in sort of mutual friends. Some of those are, the most interesting one is Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was, I knew when I started the book that he was a foremost literary Darwinian and that Higginson was an abolitionist hero, and he had fought to free a fugitive slave and had a huge saber scar across his face from that time when he tried to fight the police because he was such a passionate abolitionist. He was also in the Civil War, he was a colonel in one of the first Black regiment in the Union Army. So he was an amazing sort of inspiring political figure. And he was passionately devoted to Darwinian ideas because from Darwin, he got the idea that all human beings of every race were part of a single species and that therefore racial discrimination of any sort, including and especially slavery, was just made absolutely no sense. It was unconscionable in part because of the deep fundamental biological links between all humans. So I knew he was a Darwinian, and I also knew that he was Dickinson's great mentor who she corresponded with for many years. What I was really excited to find out when I was researching the book, I was just amazed, was that Higginson actually visited Charles Darwin at his house in Kent. Charles Darwin was pretty reclusive, so he didn't have many visitors, but one of the visitors he had was Thomas Wentworth Higginson. Darwin admired Higginson because he'd been such a hero fighting for abolition and then in the Civil War. And he invited him to stay at his house. And Higginson also was one of the few people who made it past Dickinson's social defenses. She didn't invite many people in either. But she invited Higginson in. And so in the 1870s, Higginson actually visited Dickinson, then Darwin, then Dickinson, then Darwin. He sort of kept going back and forth. And so he was probably the closest personal link that I found between the two of them. And I was delighted that I actually found that close link because as I was starting the research, I didn't think I was going to find a person like that who knew both of them. I thought it was all going to be more abstract influences and ways that they were connected through ideas, but not through an actual social circle. So I was delighted when I found that evidence of a social circle.
You also focus in upon particular moments that you see as connecting these two, who, and I love the phrase that you use to describe them as unlikely kinsmen, which is a phrase that I've never seen those two words paired together before, and yet at the same time it's such a wonderfully evocative phrase for the connections that you describe. Could you perhaps describe maybe one or two of those moments in which you have these, you know, two seemingly, you know, geographically distant, seemingly disparate people, you connecting in the ways that really get to the heart of what you're communicating with your book?
Yeah, well, my book starts with one of those moments, which is in the summer of 1858. Both of them are, it's a time of epidemic. Scarlet fever is raging in England, and there are lots and lots of illness around them, and both of them have serious illnesses in their families in 1858, and both of them turn to orchids. They turn to their gardens their gardens, and then to the wild orchids that are just beyond their cultivated gardens. And as they deal with their terrible family illnesses, they also are really, like, the comfort that they find is in going out into the woods and looking for wild orchids. The other thing that happens in that summer of 1858 is that they both start their big projects. They search for orchids, and Charles Darwin finally starts writing on The Origin of Species, which he's put off for a long, long time. And Dickinson starts to collect her poetry into booklets that are called fascicles, little booklets that she sews together of her own poems. Those are their two greatest projects that either of them ever embarks on. And they both start them that same summer in the context of terrifying family illnesses. For Dickinson, it's okay. Her mother survives, and no one in her family dies that summer. For Darwin, it's not okay. His youngest son, Charles Waring Darwin, who's named after him, actually dies of scarlet fever, and he's completely, completely heartbroken. And the solution for him is to walk out to the Orcas Bank and consider the way that on that tangled bank, everything, the living and the dead, is all tied together. The birds are eating worms, and it's just terrible because it's violent. But at the same time, there's all this new stuff that's growing. And that tangled bank becomes central to what he writes in On the Origin of Species. Dickinson, in her first fascicle, writes that to him who keeps an orchis heart, the swamps are pink with June. And so that's a great example, I think, of, like, this summer of illness and death, summer of orchids, and summer of both of these people on either side of the Atlantic deciding, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to write something great. And that's what both of them start at that time. That's one moment of crossover. There are so many, and they're all like that, right? They're like, kind of like, okay, this is happening to both of them, and they both really care about it, and yet they don't know each other. Dickinson never left the United States. She traveled on the Eastern Seaboard, but she never went to England. And Darwin made it all the way around the world, but he never went to the United States. So they had no chance to meet each other at all. But they did have lots of little moments where things came together in interesting and strange ways. They both had Newfoundland dogs. that looked pretty similar that were incredibly important to them. And they wrote a lot about observing their dogs. Dickinson apparently wrote or told Higginson that she thought that her dog understood the theory of gravitation. So she loved her dog, and she was always puzzling about what did he know, what did he think. Darwin felt the same way about his dogs and his Newfoundland dog. I guess he would leave his house to go out, and then sometimes he would go on long walks across the countryside and think and think and think. And other times he would go into his greenhouse and start doing little experiments. And the dog, Bobby, would watch, and then if he turned toward the greenhouse, would just like melt into despair and disappointment. If he turned towards the woods, his dog would just go wild with joy. And for Darwin, that was something that he ended up writing a lot about in his book on the expression of emotions. He was just fascinated that dogs and his dog had ways of expressing emotions that communicated to humans perfectly well. He perfectly knew the emotions of his dog. I think that gets to another thing. So they both love dogs. Lots of us love dogs. They both like Newfies. Newfies are cool. It's all understandable. But what's interesting for both of them is where they take it. And they both take it to that it's hard to find a line between humans and animals, and that they both are really interested in their own kinship with an animal in another species. And that sort of larger question of where's the line between humans and other animals, where's the line between one animal species and another, is something that fascinates them both, and that they both write quite a bit about. And so with Dickinson in her poetry, she's very often sort of personifying flowers and birds, and she's writing about the struggle for existence that Darwin would describe it, as Darwin would describe it. She's often writing about that, but she's writing about it in a way that seems kind of anthropomorphizing. It almost makes all of these creatures, the flowers, the bees, into something that's not so divided from human beings. And Darwin, of course, that's his whole project, right? Is to discover the connections between separate species, and the ways that we are all, that all living things are connected in the great tree of life. So most of his experiments in one way or another get to that point where you can't really tell, is it a plant? Is it an animal? He's fascinated by the root tips of plants, because he thinks oh my gosh, plants have little brains at the ends of their roots that actually make choices and decide whether to go down or up. And it's a form of brain. He's fascinated by that. He's also fascinated, and he's the one who discovers, I love this story, he discovers that plants can be carnivorous and can eat meat. And he's out, he had a terrible summer as right when On the Origin of Species was published. He was condemned by a lot of people because they thought that it was anti-Christian and heretical, and the politics around it were really quite violent. And as people were debating that at scientific meetings and stuff, Darwin backed out. He didn't go to any of the meetings. Instead, he just went walking outdoors and discovered a property of sundews that he never guessed, that nobody had ever noticed before, which is that they were carnivorous, that they were actually catching flies and eating them, and that it wasn't really clear whether the plants, the sundews that he was discovering, were actually plants or were they animals. That kind of question is the kind of question that Darwin was just endlessly fascinated by, and Dickinson was too, just What does it mean if everything is deeply connected? What does that mean if species aren't separate, if humans are somehow related to violets and to Venus flytraps and to mushrooms and to earthworms? I think it's magical, and I think it's the kind of thing that ties their thoughts together.
That is one of the things that I was struck. Yeah, I took most from your book, which is the sense of how you're describing how two people who are in some ways remarkably similar are approaching the same issue, but from the diametrically different perspectives. The scientist considering the mystical, the poet considering the scientific, and how the conclusions they oftentimes reach and the viewpoints that they bring to it are oftentimes so remarkably similar.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I mean, part of that is probably because Dickinson was influenced by Darwin, right? So it's not that they're just completely in parallel. He's 20 years older, and On the Origin of Species is published in the very end of 1859, and most of Dickinson's poetry that she saved is from after 1859. So part of it is just a question of influence. And so part of what's happening is that Dickinson, who, I mean, this is a weird thing to say, but I will say it, Dickinson had a better formal scientific education than Darwin, right? So for Darwin, he was a great scientist, but at the time that he was going to Cambridge, you couldn't get a degree in the sciences. So, although he knew many great scientists and he became a great scientist, he didn't have a degree in sciences. And Dickinson, on the other hand, 20 years later, and in America, which was a little bit more STEM focused at the time, and interestingly, for Dickinson in Massachusetts, at that time, people thought that it wasn't appropriate for girls to study classical languages, because that would lead toward public careers in politics or as a clergyman or something like that. So they really didn't think that girls should study classical languages, because that would lead to a profession. So smart girls, what people decided in the public education system of Massachusetts was that they should study the sciences, because that would challenge their brains, and be a good, interesting, good thing for girls to do. But also, at the time when she was in school, before Darwin, people thought that the more you studied science, the less radical you would be, the more you would discover that the world was very well organized and hierarchical. And so it made a lot of sense to push girls to study those kinds of things, astronomy, where all the planets move exactly as you expect, and botany, where everything is divided neatly into separate species. So that's why she got such a great scientific education. But then, with that background, she was just perfectly poised to understand what happened when science went crazy in the 1860s and 70s. And it's not just that biology changed with Darwin, but physics changed and chemistry changed, and everything went in the sciences went from very neat hierarchies to really wild, unexpected relationships and transformations and changes. And because of her education, Dickinson was one of the few people in the Americas, who was really well equipped to understand that. It really surprises people that figures like Emerson and Higginson, who had such great educations at Harvard, actually didn't have the opportunity to study natural sciences. There were at Harvard, as there were at Cambridge University, where Darwin went, there were lectures in natural sciences, there were natural history collections, there were telescopes, but it wasn't part of the formal curriculum in either of those places. And what's interesting is one of the reasons it wasn't part of the formal curriculum was because people thought of it as a little bit feminine, or a little bit working class. So the sciences were a little bit more outsider areas. And insiders, as I said, did classical languages. Amherst College at the time was an outsider school where they included science in the central curriculum right from the start. And that was part of what made Dickinson's opportunities so unique for anywhere in the world, was that she attended Amherst Academy. And Amherst Academy had a policy where students could learn by going to the Amherst College lectures. So that meant that she had lots of opportunities to go to formal college lectures on the natural sciences, an opportunity that was very rare anywhere for anyone, but that surprisingly was a little bit more available to women students in Massachusetts than to male students in Massachusetts.
It's interesting also to think about how that sort of convergence or that sort of opportunity for influence is one that's available to someone like Dickinson, but is not necessarily available to a poet or a writer of a later generation. And how it really kind of gets to the uniqueness of the moment that you're describing, where there is still enough of a melding and yet enough of a distinction to where you can have this remarkable crossover that you describe.
Yeah, it is really, really interesting. I have a good friend who's a scientist, and she and I were just talking the other day about how we went to high school together and we got tracked. It was very clear by the time we were in 11th grade, she was going into the sciences, that had been decided. And I was going into the humanities, that had been decided, and not necessarily decided by us. simply, you know, it was where we seemed to have our strengths. And once we were typed, it got harder and harder to cross over. I think that's pretty typical for people who are in American and British and European education at this point, is you get tracked pretty early, and then it's hard to go across what have become pretty large divides between disciplinary approaches. I think that's bad for us. I don't think that helps us solve any of the great problems that we face. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm really drawn to this period, is because that was a time when those divisions were not hard and fast. And I think something was lost as they divided.
We appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us. But before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So I'm finishing up a project on the one that I started a billion years ago on Dickinson and astronomy, which, as I've written it, has become more about Dickinson and planetary ecology, sort of thinking about Earth as a planet. And that one is almost done, really close. And then the next one that's on the books for me, like in my hopes, what I hope to be working on this summer, is gonna be, I'm turning back to Moby Dick. And it's a book, it's called Hidden Hands. And it's about all of the people, starting with Herman Melville's sisters and family, and the scientists and ecologists who sort of worked in the background to create Moby Dick. So that's my next one. That'll be a few years, but I'm really looking forward to spending some time, as I sort of say farewell to Dickinson, I want to spend some time with Herman Melville.
Well, those both sound like fantastic projects. I look forward to seeing them when they come out.
Oh, thank you so much.
Renee, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Oh, you too, Mark. It was a great pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Oh, I feel like the pleasure's all on my end.
Take care.